When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to another episode on the New Books Network. I'm one of your hosts, Dr. Miranda Melcher, and I'm very pleased today because we get to talk about a fascinating thing, a fascinating book, The Swimming Pool. This book, with that title, is published by Bloomsbury as part of the Object Lessons series and explores the swimming pool as many things, as a thing that people actually use to swim in, but also a thing that we think about that impacts our art, that impacts our literature, and so much more. So I'm very pleased to welcome the author of the book, Dr. Piotr Florczyk, to the podcast to tell us all about it. Piotr, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really happy to be here.
We're very happy to have you. Could you start off, please, by introducing yourself a little bit and explain why you decided to write this book?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. Like you said, my name is Piotr Florczyk. I'm a poet, translator, essayist, critic, and scholar. I teach at the University of Washington in Seattle, and I live with my family in Los Angeles. And I wrote Swimming Pool because I've always been fascinated by the world of swimming as a former competitive swimmer, and also as someone who loves to think and look at structures and consider how they influence us, how they make us who we are. And that's pretty much it, how the swimming pool came to be.
What an interesting sort of combination of thoughts to bring you into a project like this. And in fact, I'd love to ask you, as we start, a bit more about your own background and relationship with swimming. The competitive swimmer aspect, I think, deserves to be discussed first.
Yeah, thank you. I'll be happy to say a few things about that. I'm originally from Poland, and I was born... Well, I suppose I can reveal that. I was born in 1978, and... this is to say that my childhood was spent in communist Poland. And what that means in context of swimming pool in our conversation here today is that swimming lessons were part of a mandatory part of PE when I was a kid in Poland, growing up in Poland. And so in third grade, my classmates and I trekked to the local swimming pool to take swimming lessons instead of, say, I don't know, playing basketball or soccer. And I did well enough that at the end of that year, I was invited to join a swim team, which meant that I would be switching schools and essentially going to a special school for athletes, et cetera, et cetera. And so I became a competitive swimmer, someone who practiced twice a day and went to competitions and training camps when I was about 10 or 11. And this is also how I ended up eventually in the United States. In 1994, I was offered a swimming fellowship by the Polish Swimming Federation. And the idea was that I would go to the United States, particularly Southern California, to train with an American team. And I did that. And I'm still here. I'm still here, meaning I'm still in the States. I ended up swimming through college and a little bit after college as a pro swimmer. Met my wife, who was also herself an excellent swimmer. And so swimming has always been a big part of my life, both as an athlete, but also as a recreational swimmer.
Hmm. Obviously, that's a pretty unique relationship with swimming that I think not necessarily that many people have. But that doesn't mean that a lot of people don't have any relationship to swimming. There's quite, I think, a widespread population that have some engagement with it and certainly fascination around swimming pools. What do you think the common denominator might be around this kind of thing that so many of us have in terms of being attracted to, enticed by, intrigued by swimming pools?
Well, I would say we love swimming pools because they signify play and carefree moments. But I would also say that in a way we also dislike them for those very same reasons, especially if we can't swim or if we have no access to them. One of the chapters in my book, in fact, deals with the idea of who gets to swim. They also denote status. And I think many of us would identify with the notion that, hey, if a neighbor has a pool and we don't, then we envy that neighbor or try to become friends with them so we can use their pool on sultry summer days.
Yeah, no, I think there's a bunch of things there. I want to make sure, though, that we are, I suppose, not sloppy with our language, given how important language is. I admit, hadn't really thought about this distinction until I read your book and went, okay, he's got a point there. So I think there's going to be some listeners who are probably in the same camp. Before we go any further in our discussion of swimming pools, can you walk us through the difference of what is a swimming pool versus maybe just a pool?
Yeah, of course, I would love to. Well, is there a distinction? I think there is, right? Are you channeling something I said in my book? I think you are. Well, it's a great question, and you know, I might be biased again because of my past as a competitive swimmer. But to my mind, a swimming pool is a place where we go to do laps, either as part of an organized workout or team, or as weekend warriors on Saturdays, as it were. Whereas a pool is a place that's synonymous, again, in my mind, with doing, I don't know, cannonballs or floating on an inner tube, you know, drink in hand, or playing Marco Polo, or just taking a dip, like I said, to cool off when the weather gets too hot. I mean, most pools versus swimming pools are, you know, fairly small in terms of their dimensions. They can be deep, but typically they're not. And so you can't really do laps in a small pool. I mean, think about a hotel pool. A hotel pool would be a pool, definitely not a swimming pool. And as we speak, I happen to be staying in a hotel in Gainesville, Florida. And when I checked in a couple of days ago, my first question was, is there a swimming pool here? And I was told, yes, there is a fitness center and a swimming pool, and it's on the top floor. But my follow-up question immediately was, well, is it a pool or is it a swimming pool? And the gentleman looked at me with this puzzled look, and I said, well, can you do laps in it, or is it more like something that you would splash in? And he kind of smirked and said, definitely not for swimming, more for splashing in. So there you have it. That would be sort of my very basic rudimentary distinction between a swimming pool and a pool.
But yet one that very much works in the real world, as that example demonstrates.
That's right.
I wonder if we can maybe move from talking about like literal physical pools that you may or may not be able to swim laps in to the representations of them, for example, in visual art. Could you talk a little bit about kind of how you went about investigating this in the book and maybe anything that particularly jumped out at you as interesting or significant in that process?
So I had spent quite a bit actually looking at various photographs of swimming pools, paintings, you know, someone like David Hockney, for instance, you know, whose work I've been familiar with for a long time, but it was really nice to revisit some of his more famous paintings with swimming pools or pools in them. The American artist Ed Ruscha had also investigated swimming pools in his work. But because of what I've said about swimming pools being very much representative of a particular status, material status, one's societal standing, etc. I also did look at advertisements and brochures put out by home builders, for instance. This idea that, hey, you know, we can build your dream house, and here are some of the options that we can put in. And, you know, swimming pool is often one of those options. I've also talked to friends who are, like myself, literature scholars, but also folks who work in other disciplines, people who are film scholars, for instance, because, again, I think pools and swimming pools have been used by filmmakers to represent one's, I don't know, inner turmoil, for instance. And of course, the book ends, and this was really important to me, and I knew I wanted to do this right from the very beginning. The book ends, well, it begins and it ends with memoir pieces where I write about myself and my relationship to swimming and swimming pools. The first chapter, of course, looking back on the pandemic and how suddenly we were banned from accessing our local municipal swimming pools in Los Angeles. And the last chapter is about what you've already hinted at, which is my journey from the world of world rankings as a competitive swimmer to, you know, the pages of literary magazines and writing books, writing poems, and translating contemporary Polish poetry into English.
And I think as we've touched on the first, we're going to get to the second. But as you said, they sort of bookend the book. So staying, I suppose, more in the middle of it for a bit, you mentioned speaking about swimming pools with friends and colleagues. I'm wondering if you could maybe tell us a bit more about kind of what came up when you asked them about swimming pools that maybe you hadn't thought of already.
Well, I don't think there were, say, new things I learned from speaking with my friends about it, but they did confirm that, you know, every swimming pool acts as a kind of a reproduction of an open body of water, representing new beginnings. For many migrants like myself, literally so. For instance, a casino pool is both a place to hide and a place to partake in an ancient ritual of rebirth or baptism. One of my friends put it that way. I thought that was really, really interesting. And again, swimming or just floating in a pool allows the human form to lose its nomen omen form, to become one with the water, so to speak. Of course, the pool exerts a great amount of pressure on the body, what with the walls enclosing us in. But at the same time, the feeling of weightlessness is rather otherworldly, I would say. Moreover, because we can see ourselves reflected in water, pools or any bodies of water, really, get the imagination going. That's no different, I would say, than amazing, imposing, or intricate buildings, or even, you know, landscapes, mountains, right? There's nothing, people often complain about having to drive through a flat area where there's nothing for the eye to really be attracted by. And swimming pools are kind of like that. You know, it's a hole in the ground for the most part. I mean, there's, of course, above ground pools as well, but it's a hole in the ground and it's a gateway. It's a gateway, if nothing else, than for the imagination, as I put it, to you know, to get going. It stirs it, it troubles it, it entices us to imagine ourselves entering, you know, taking a dip or going in for a swim. But also, like in one of David Hockney's paintings, you know, is to kind of look at that very, I would say, broken reflection of ourselves, broken by the wake, of course, rather than the surface itself, but especially an outdoor pool, right? If there is a bit of a breeze and there is a wake on the water, on the surface, the reflection becomes broken, as I put it, or fractured. And there's something kind of amazing of sort of looking at oneself and getting back this distorted picture of oneself.
No, absolutely. I suppose I kind of want to extend that of the distortion. What happens when the swimming pool is empty, when it's literally just a hole in the ground without these refractive elements?
Well, what a waste. What a waste. That would be my initial response. And, you know, that happens every once in a while. I mean, in California, for instance, you know, during dry spells, you know, when there is a, you know, we've had, say, a really bad or non-existent rainy season, and a lot of pools get emptied out. And in fact, that's how skateboarders became kind of synonymous in some circles with empty swimming pools and, you know, breaking into houses and whatnot, and taking advantage of that typically very smooth surface of the pool. So yeah, what a waste. But and I think probably indicative of lots of other things, right? Not just a drought, but also municipal troubles, which is something I also write about in the book, how some of the pools I frequented as a child growing up in Kraków, Poland, eventually were sort of abandoned by the state, by the local government, and they fell into disuse and disrepair, and it took a really long time for the funds to be found so the pools can still serve the local community.
That is sad to think about, but interesting as well. I'm wondering if we can kind of pick that thread back up of your memoir aspect of the book, and kind of you briefly hinted at it earlier, the transition out of swimming. Why can't one be a poet and a serious athlete at the same time?
Did I actually say that? Are you quoting me?
Well, you sort of hinted at it and then said, actually, I don't know if I still think that. So I'm wondering kind of, is that true?
Well, let me begin by saying that, you know, when I meet people and they learn that about me, you know, the journey from a jock, from an athlete, you know, someone who swam 10 miles a day and, you know, cared about bettering his times and doing well at competitions and representing his country, or getting, like I did, a college scholarship so I could go to college and not have to pay for it. I mean, they are kind of puzzled by it. And some people are, in a way, I felt that before, even threatened by it, you know, like, who is this guy? He should have stayed in his lane and remained an athlete, or perhaps gone into coaching, which is something I did actually after I retired as a swimmer. And then on the other hand, some people are kind of fascinated by it. And I think some of that stems from the fact that, you know, a jock is a jock. A lot of people kind of, you know, look down on people who are athletes, particularly young, serious athletes. You know, they think we have, you know, these, I don't know, really limited interests when it comes to other things in life. And all we care about is, you know, beating the guy in the lane, in the next lane over, or coming in first, etc. And there's some truth in that. I think the serious dedication that it takes to be a successful athlete, in addition to, you know, innate ability or talent, etc., I think that's there. I think that's part of the game. But you know, at the same time, I think one can be both. I mean, I'm a good, you know, proof of that. But when I reflected on that in the book, I really aimed to unpack first then complicate the various stereotypes, like I said, about jocks and artistic types that are ingrained in our culture. And I think the world over, not just in America, but in Poland, certainly as well. And in short, however, you know, I think the point I was trying to make when I wrote that that world-class athletes have a single-minded dedication to the pursuit of athletic glory is that being a writer, being a poet, being a translator also takes a lot of dedication. And we see that with our students, for instance, many of whom attend and complete, say, creative writing courses, and for various reasons, again. But I think the sad truth is that, you know, within a year or two of completing, graduating from an MFA in creative writing program, most people stop writing, and that's because, life intervenes. We have to say that, you know, life intervenes, things happen, etc. But also because there's no plan, if you will. There's no plan. There's a goal, writing a book of poems and hopefully getting it published. But how one goes about doing that, and then more importantly, how one goes from point A, you know, starting to write, to point B, actually publishing a book, that takes a lot of dedication, perseverance, being able to come up with, creative writing exercises for oneself, right? Being able to, you know, being able to generate new work takes a lot of planning. And again, being able, having that discipline to be able to sit down every day, say, or every other day, and stare at that blank piece of paper or the computer screen for a really long time. And let me also add that there is a reason why, for better or worse, we refer to world-class athletes as machines. That's just not a linguistic tick. I think there's something to that. I mean, think about someone like, I mean, he's been disgraced as a cheat, but Lance Armstrong, for instance, you know, his, people talked at length about his dedication to the pursuit of athletic glory. Michael Phelps, the same thing. And again, my experience also speaks to that. The idea of, particularly during training trips, attending a training session in the morning and then retiring to, my room. And I would read a book, but sometimes I would just want to sleep or play video games, you know, do something that would take my mind off of the grueling session I just completed. And the fact that in a couple hours, I have to do it all over again. So athletes, you know, train, sleep, eat, and then train some more. And the second their mind, I would say, begins to wander, I think they're done as athletes. I think the focus and maintaining the focus is really key. At the same time, you know, what's poetry if not a place or state of mind where we wonder and wander, sometimes aimlessly for hours on end? And and that's sort of the fun part of being a poet, but I think the act actually, of writing, that's hard work. And so can one be both? Yes, but with a certain caveat thrown in there, I would say.
Staying, kind of adding on, I guess, to that idea of they're both work, even if very different kinds, have you found similarities between the two, or things that you've brought with you from being a competitive athlete into poetry?
I think, like I just said, having taught literature and creative writing for almost two decades now, I can tell you that most young writers or those who dream of becoming a poet have no idea how hard it is to stay the course, which is exactly what being an athlete teaches you. That is, sports are all about having a goal, developing a plan for achieving it, and then executing it. And, you know, likewise, writing is hard work. Sure, the so-called inspiration or what have you plays a huge role in it, but studies show that those writers, and I'm including poets in this bunch, who consistently work on their craft get to be more successful, ultimately. And this is not the same as being productive. After all, and I'm going to quote, if I may, a poem or a section of a poem by the poet, the late poet Adam Zagajewski. This poem is called "The Room I Work In." And Adam wrote, "Clearly, others aren't wasting time while I work, seeking adventures on earth and or in the air, excuse me. And what is my work? Waiting motionless, flipping pages, patient meditation, passivities not pleasing to that judge with the greedy gaze. I write as slowly as if I'll live 200 years." And this is a poem in translation by Claire Kavanagh.
Thank you for sharing that with us. I'm going to guess that from what you've just told us about kind of putting the work in, and obviously your experience in watching students do this and engaging with it yourself, that even though this book is done, this book is available, people can go read it, you're probably working on some things. Is there anything you'd like to preview or highlight for our audience?
Yeah, I'd love to. Thank you for asking. Well, as a former athlete, I prefer and really like to work on several projects at the same time. So I would say, thank you for asking. I would love to say a couple things about things I'm working on. And I wonder if I'm going to contradict myself now, because I like to work on several things at the same time. And again, that implies maybe lack of some kind of singular focus on a particular project at hand. But no, there are projects I'm working on. Sometimes that, you know, the process itself, as I've mentioned, includes not really doing a whole lot, or not doing a whole lot to someone who may be, you know, that proverbial fly on the wall, just looking at, why is this guy sitting at his desk and just flipping through some books and not really doing anything? Where's the writing actually going to take place? But I am writing, I am researching a lot of different things. And one of the projects is a collection of essays on Polish and American poets influencing one another. I've actually already submitted the manuscript to the press, and I'm waiting to hear from the peer reviewers. This project stems directly from my research. I'm very much interested as a scholar in how, in translation, and particularly not so much, you know, how we translate something, even though that is of some interest to me, but rather in the issue of selection and, you know, what gets translated and why. And our listeners may be familiar with this actually, but, you know, roughly in the mid to late 1960s, a lot of American poets became, and British poets actually too, became very interested in Central and Eastern European poets. So I'm looking at that, trying to tease out, answer the question as to why, you know, what was it that the West found fascinating? And not just fascinating, because it's more than that. It's an issue of, you know, we know that dominant literary cultures will often look overseas for certain models, but that they will only adapt certain aspects of that source, tradition, etc. And interestingly enough, roughly 20 years later, so in the late 1980s, a similar transfer took place, but in the opposite direction. And young Polish poets who were coming of age at the time essentially said no to some of their famous models in Poland and looked elsewhere, and especially to American poets. And so I'm fascinated by that. So I write about that in this collection of essays. And as an essayist, and I must say, I had really enjoyed doing the research that went into the swimming pool, and I really had fun writing the book. I hope that shows in the in the writing itself. But I'm now sort of thinking about doing something similar. So another short essay length book, this time on commuting, because as I mentioned at the start of our conversation, I teach, I work at the University of Washington in Seattle, but I live in Los Angeles, and we're talking about roughly 2.5 hour flight between LA and Seattle, and I commute every week, and it's been an interesting experience, should we say, getting on the plane every day with tourists and some business people, you know, Seattle, think Microsoft, Amazon. So I imagine some of the people, and some of whom I see the same people on some of the flights week after week. They're probably going up there to do something in the tech world. And there's myself, you know, a kind of an intellectual migrant, if you will, getting on the plane so I can teach, I can talk about literature with students and my colleagues. So I'm you know, pitching almost, you know, a proposal to a press about doing a book that you guessed it would be called Commuting. and I'm writing poems. I mean, this is a really long answer to your question, but I'm writing poems and I'm translating. Siegel Books is going to release a co-translation of mine this fall. There's a book of poems in English. There's a book of poems in Polish I'm working on. So lots of things in the pipeline. And that's how I like it. And I wonder if I may add this. This may be too much information, although that's also in the book. So I'm not really revealing too much about myself, but this idea of juggling lots of different projects, I think that really connects well with my personality. Someone who doesn't necessarily grow bored with things, but someone who is interested in a lot of different things and likes to be stimulated by, again, different facets of our life, or, you know, different authors, different films, and sports too. I mean, I still swim quite a bit, actually. I also coach swimming. I coach one workout per week for a master's team in Los Angeles. And so these two halves, if you will, of who I am are still very much, very much at play.
How fascinating, just like they are in the book we've been discussing.
Thank you
for that, and for giving us the fun sneak preview into what might be coming next. But of course, in the meantime, listeners can read the book titled Swimming Pool, published by Bloomsbury as part of the Object Lesson series. Piotr, thank you so much for being with us on the podcast.
Thank you so much to you, Miranda. I really enjoyed our conversation. Thank you.